From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Opening ceremonies for the London Summer Olympics 1 month from today. In London, massive preparations underway for the Games. Around the world and in the U.S., final competitions are on for a place on national teams. Last night in Omaha, Nebraska, it was Michael Phelps versus Ryan Lochte, head-to-head in the pool for the 200-meter freestyle semifinals.
They're going to go 1-2. What order is it going to be? Lochte just barely over Phelps.
And it was Lochte by a split second. This hour On Point will preview the London Olympics and talk with top American athletes who are preparing to compete in the Games. You can join the conversation. Are you counting down to the Olympics, sending a hometown hero? What do these games to me mean to you, to us, in a time when there's so much else going on in the world? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Radio. We'll hear from athletes in a moment. First, let's go to London and to the stateside jostling to make the American teams. With us from London is Alex Wolf, senior staff writer for Sports Illustrated, now covering his sixth Summer Olympics. He's seen it all. Alex Wolf, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And with us from San Jose, California, is John Powers, great sports writer for the Boston Globe. He's covered the Olympics since 1976. Talk about a lot of games. He was in Omaha, Nebraska this week for the Olympic swimming trials for Team USA. Now he's in San Jose for the gymnastics trials and soon headed to London himself. John Powers, it's great to have you back as well.
Hi, John.
John, we'll go to London, but big picture, U.S. team, I know they're still deciding this year, but how does the U.S. look placed in this great international festival of sport?
Well, it's interesting. Last time in Beijing, the Chinese won the gold medal count. I think this time they are prepared to win the overall medal count as well. It's not as though the Chinese are going to be winning a ton more medals, although they'll do very well. The Americans won't win nearly as many. Still clearly they depend so much on track and field and swimming for most of it, and as many of the other events that they probably won't do nearly as well as they did in Beijing.
Track and field, swimming, strongholds for the U.S. What beyond that, John? What looks strong this time out?
As we've seen last time, the U.S. gymnastics team is quite good. As a matter of fact, one of the great dramas of the trials is whether the class of 2008 from Beijing, which is led by Nastya Liukin, the all-around champion, Alicia Sacramone, can make it here. They both took time off, came back, got hurt, and the new women are the world champions, led by Jordan Weaver. So that's the one I think most Americans will be watching in addition to the track and the swimming.
And what about this competition? We heard just a little bit of it there, right there, Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte. Phelps, of course, with 14 gold medals, more than any other athlete ever. How did those two look shaping up in swimming?
Well, I think everyone knew that Lochte would be the top man coming in, but Michael, who had taken a fair amount of time off and was beaten head-to-head by Lochte, has come back reborn, if you will. What he wants is the all-time record for all Olympians for medals, which now is 18, held by Larissa Latynina, the Soviet gymnast of the 50s and 60s. He'll get that easily. What he could do, and he's been very cagey about this week, he was 8 for 8 gold medals in Beijing. Mm-hmm. He could go for 9 events if he wants to. If he makes the team in the 100 freestyle, he'll be shooting for 9. He won't get 9 medals at all, but it'll be a great storyline coming in. And, of course, on night one in Beijing, I'm sorry, night one in London, you'll have Lochte and Phelps going head-to-head.
Famously, fierce competitors there. John Powers, stand by in San Jose. We want to hear about the gymnastics trials coming up there. Alex Wolf, take us to London. I mean, the last time a lot of people paid attention here or have the sort of top memory from Beijing was that opening ceremony, that huge scale, that huge feel of drummers going at it, everything on kind of epic size and scale there. Beijing went for gigantic spectacle. How's London approaching these games, Alex?
And just the opposite, Tom. I mean, I can only imagine what it was like for Sebastian Coe, head of the London Organizing Committee, to sit 4 years ago in that stadium in Beijing.
And jaw-dropping.
Wonder, yeah, how are we going to top this? And I think what they've done is taken that challenge and enshrined it as a kind of virtue and said, look, we're gonna use British understatement here. They do have the virtue here of games 4 years after this very tightly controlled games in Beijing that had this grim efficiency to them. So I think there's going to be a lot of festivity. There'll be a lot of rock and roll. We got a little foretaste, I think, during the Queen's Diamond Jubilee of how the Brits can do these big spectacles. They're very adept at it. They were actually projecting on the front of Buckingham Palace during the Jubilee concert council flats, these housing projects right on Buckingham Palace while they had that British group Madness playing their hit Our House.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real puckishness, I think, in the way the Brits are going to put this on. And Seb Coe keeps saying again and again, look, these are going to be sustainable games. These are going to be responsible games. It's not just because we're in a time of austerity in England. It's because that's what we want to prove. We want to prove to Rio. We want to prove to perhaps an Indian or South African city that might someday want to host that it can be done on the relative cheap.
Sustainable games meaning environmentally or just budget conscious after years of budget busting games all over?
Well, you've touched on quite a nerve there, Tom. It's everybody now says they're sustainable in a green sense. I mean, you can't go to the World Cup, any major sporting event where they aren't recycling water to flush toilets, you name it. I think what London has aspired to has been much more of an anti-giantism games that would be sustainable in a financial sense. And in fact, they've doubled the budget on security. The original, shortly after they got the games in 05, the original forecasts were, hey, we're only going to spend X. And now they revised it two years after that. So the budget itself overall has doubled. And in fact, there was a study from the Oxford University School, Said School of Business, that just came out that said that if you allow for the fact that in Beijing they were using this incredibly cheap labor to build those venues, mm-hmm. these indeed will be the most expensive. Security is the great suck here because the Brits are so mindful of what happened literally the day after they won the bid on 7-7.
This was July 7th when they had their version of 9-11, the bombs in the subway in London.
Exactly. And they're so conscious of that. And that, in fact, has colored the mood here. You have to understand this is a country that people were sitting in the tube and on the buses reading about the winning of the games on the morning of July 7th, 2005, still celebrating from that news when these bombs went off. And since then, they've had this horrible recession and the riots of last summer. So there's a kind of pent-up desire, I think, to let loose that we're going to see on display in late July.
We hope that everybody can enjoy it, but everybody also knows they're talking about surface-to-air missiles and fighter jets and helicopters and warships and a massive number of security folks. John Powers, you'll be heading to London soon. You've seen, like Alex Wolf, so many games. I mean, every time the games face a little different global zeitgeist, right? Zeitgeist, each time out. What do you think these are? What do these need to be to fit into the world as we see it right now?
Well, I think one thing people are actually rooting for is to see countries that are under siege, athletes from places like Syria, Afghanistan, or female athletes from places like Saudi Arabia, Brunei, Qatar, that have never sent women before, to see if they can get on the world stage in a bit. I mean, basically, this has been, with the exception of East Germany, which was a doped program for years, This has been a superpower Olympics. I mean, basically, if you look at the top of the table, it is China, U.S., Russia. And people very often root for the guy from Vietnam that, you know, makes the podium. I think this year especially, so many athletes are coming from countries in turmoil or that have been riven by civil war or that have serious domestic issues or, in some cases, are flat broke. So I think that's one of the things that we look for is where are the interesting stories, because this is, 200-plus countries in the world get together once every 4 years.
Yeah. Alex, where are they centering these Olympics in London? Have they cleared some area of the city or outside the city, or is it all over the city? What's the setup?
Well, there'll be the places like Wimbledon for the tennis and Eton, the famous playing fields of Eton. Eton will be hosting the rowing very close to Windsor Castle. So there'll be these kind of iconic old English venues. But the big project has been the reclamation of the East End of London. Think of the Hackney Marshes, the place that Fagin took Oliver Twist, where the old dog track was that London punters would go to lay down a bet on some greyhounds. Lots of industry had been cleared out there, and they put in a 500-acre park, which will be the center of most of the activity in the games. At the south end is a huge shopping mall, the largest shopping mall to be built in Europe. And you won't be able to get into the south end of the Olympic Park without running a gauntlet of commercialism, literally, going through this shopping mall. But it's a very ambitious project, and not without some justification, the Brits are saying, hey, we've thrown some real resources into a long-term redevelopment of this part of London, a huge swath of land that has been crying out for redevelopment.
And the Olympics will help make that happen. Tickets we'll talk about. Giant screens going to broadcast Olympic events live to presumably thousands in Trafalgar Square and Hyde Park and Victoria Park for free. All kinds of rock and roll, and not all, some new, some old Tom Jones coming out to croon a little bit. Alex Wolff, please stand by there in London where the Olympics will see their opening ceremony 1 month from today. And John Powers in San Jose, California, there for gymnastics trials as the U.S. puts its teams together, the final membership. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the London Olympics and with U.S. athletes preparing to compete there. Alex Wolff is with us from London, senior staff writer for Sports Illustrated. He's seen a lot of Olympics, and he's there watching London get ready for these opening ceremonies 1 month from today. John Powers has been attending Olympics since 1976. He's in San Jose, California right now. Was in Omaha for swimming trials this week. Now he's in San Jose for gymnastics. He's with us as well. Alex, John, please stand by. We've got a wonderful little parade of athletes coming in here. And the first in line is Tony Azevedo. He joins us from Thousand Oaks, California. He is captain of the USA water polo national team, a silver medalist in the 2008 Olympic Games. 2012 Olympics in London will be his fourth Olympic competition. Tony Azevedo, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Where are you in your training now, Tony? Is it home stretch? Are you still waiting? Where exactly are you in the sort of process of getting ready?
Unfortunately for us, it's the Olympics is over a two week period. You know, we play every other day the whole entire time, so there's never really a downslide. It's just constant work.
And in terms of training, is there a point at which you peak and then you sort of save up a little energy for the games, or you just train, keep going all the way through?
Yeah, you train, go all the way through. Closer to the games, you start doing more VO2 max, more intense kind of trainings, but you have to actually train throughout the games because, you know, if you're only training, you're playing one game a day every 2 days, you can actually get yourself out of shape and feeling bad by the end of the tournament. So it's a fine line between how much you have to work out between games and then right before and right after. But hopefully I think we learned from the last one, and we're going to continue that.
Tony, you've seen a lot of games at this point. What are you hearing about the setup in London, the environment there? What will be greeting athletes when they arrive? What are you expecting?
I'm excited. You know, I've heard everything about the village. I think for the first time, I mean, one of the big problems for athletes is transportation. I mean, we usually are stuck in traffic for an hour on our way to venues, on our way to games. And, you know, that takes a toll on your body when you have to sit in a bus for an hour and then get to the pool an hour and a half before and then retrain yourself and focus. But now I guess everything's pretty much walking distance, at least for us in the water polo venue. Everything's green. I'm really excited to see how it looks.
Alex Wolff, there in London, Tony looks at, you know, being stuck in traffic, and all athletes know what that's like. I've heard, and you've written, Londoners are worried about their tube, their subway with all this traffic on it. For athletes, for visitors, what's getting around look like for these Olympics, Alex?
Well, it's the oldest subway system in the world, the London Underground, and there's real concern, especially on two lines, the Jubilee and the Central, which are going to be kind of the central nervous system of the whole transport system for spectators. I do think Tony and his water polo teammates don't have a lot to worry about, and all the athletes don't have a lot to worry about because the whole transport network for athletes is going to be dedicated. Sebastian Coe is the head of the organizers, having been a former Olympian himself, has put as a very top priority that the athlete experience nothing is to be skimped on for them. I do think for spectators, it's going to require a little bit of patience, some planning. Paul Dayton, the CEO of the London organizers, has said that you should expect a kind of an airport security situation. You know, expect queues are going to try to keep the max of about 20 minutes at the worst times. Maybe bring a little water bottle, but nothing more than that. Don't be packing picnic lunches or you won't be able to get them into the venue.
Tony Azevedo, in a Thousand Oaks, you come from such a family of athletes. I mean, a dozen different men and women who have been at professional sort of level in soccer, basketball, baseball, all kinds of Olympic competitions, Pan American and all the rest. When you were 4 years old, you had this big famous fall near-death experience, severed your trachea and your esophagus. Did they write you off when you were, you know, just out of toddlerhood, Tony? Did it look like it wasn't going to work for you because of that?
At that point, they were just trying to hope that I could walk again. And then, you know, with time, I mean, I think one of the great things about my family was that when I grew up, there was never any pressure to play water polo or to play a sport. It was, you know, we were very sport-oriented. We used to always, you know, play sports in our off-time, picnic together. And really, it was my decision to get into water polo and fall in love with it. So there, I never felt pressure, and I really think that made my love stronger for the game.
Your dad, of course, quite an athlete himself. He was on the Brazilian national water polo team. You were born in Rio, just spent a little time there before coming to the States. He's coached you a lot. He was U.S. national team coach. Is he still? He's currently the coach of the Chinese national team. Is that right? What's that feel like?
Yeah, it was great. We actually just battled 2 weeks ago, and his team was closest to the China's ever been to the U.S. We usually beat him by 6 to 8 goals, depending, and we beat him by 1. So he's done a great job over there, and he really loves it. He's a master of all his teams now, and he's a big fan of China.
I know sports is international, but crying out loud, Dad, do you have to coach the Chinese national team? Can you get inside their head knowing his coaching as well as you do, Tony?
Well, you know, I actually think he could probably get inside my head a little better. He knows me. He knows pretty much every little trick in the book. But when father and son battle, the son's going to take him down. And if he doesn't, then I'm going to call the mom in.
Right. Come on, Libby. What's the competition look like to you, Tony? Who's going to be battling for those three places on the podium?
You know, it's tough to say. Every Olympics, you usually have a favorite or two or ones that you have to break in. And I'd say this Olympics is you got about 6 teams out there. I mean, you have the Croatians, the Serbians, the Italians, the Hungarians, us, and maybe the Spaniards, who all any given day have a chance of winning. I mean, just we had the Hungarians and Croatians here, and we dominated the Hungarians in 2 games. We beat the Croatians. Then we just go overseas, and we lose to the Italians by 1. So it's really going to come down to the best group, the best unity, and who plays better that day.
How many hours in the pool today for you and the team, Tony?
We go, today it's a double training, so we'll go 7 hours.
Wow, that sounds Olympic. Tony Azevedo, captain of the USA water polo national team, on his way to the Olympics in London. We wish you and the team great good luck, and we're really grateful to you for joining us today. Thanks a lot, Tony.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Thank you so much. John Powers, how about those Olympic volleyball guys? What do you say?
I think they have a decent chance, but, you know, it's amazing how you look at how much things change over 4 years. We're looking at swimming where Natalie Coughlin was the female Phelps, if you will. She won 6 medals in Beijing. She may not make the American team in an individual event this time. It is so difficult to keep things going. We see changes even within 1 year. So I think U.S. volleyball, you know, what's interesting, the beach volleyball players are also very good. They went double gold in Beijing. And
sure.
That's one of the more fascinating events.
And everybody will be watching that again. We're going to hear in just a moment from Tom Pesek, who's going to be rowing. A couple of callers right here. Mike in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. John, love your column. Alex, love your writing. I'm going to London August 1st for 8 days with
Lucky
my
you.
Wife.
Wow.
It'll be my 8th Olympics,
wow.
And I'm a track and field nut. I tried to make the Olympic trials back in my day. I was just out in San Diego for a half marathon, and I got the chance to meet the Olympic marathon team, the men, as well as the great Jim Ryan, who was a silver medalist in Mexico City. And we shared stories about the 68 Olympic trials up at Echo Summit up in Lake Tahoe at 7,700 feet. and how difficult it was for him to acclimatize to the altitude. And his experiences at Mexico and Munich, which is the Olympics I cut my teeth on. But anyway, we're going to see the track and field, and I've been watching the trials all week from Eugene at Hayward Field, and just looking forward to a great experience in London. Kind of have a leg up on the field. My brother lived there for 25 years. He's back in New York now, but we've got a place to stay for free with a buddy of his. He's got the system wired in terms of transportation, and we've got two tickets to the 100-meter night, which I believe a million people tried to get tickets
for. Wow. Sounds like you're in great shape. I don't know about the athletes, but it sounds like you're in great shape for these Olympics, Mike, and we hope you have a great time there. I appreciate your call. We got lots of response online here. Yar says, I love the Olympics, celebrating the youth and ability of the world's best athletes. And he's going for that shows. We're all part of the same humanity, and people do get excited by that. At the same time, here's another comment from Terry. Says, you know, question mark after this, Hunger Games to entertain the 1%? Well, I don't know. Let's talk with an athlete. Tom Pesek joins us right now. He's headed to the Olympics. Rowing. He and his teammate Silas Stafford won the men's pair event at the Olympic trials 2 weeks ago in New Jersey. They're both headed for their first Olympic Games. He joined the University of Michigan rowing team as a sophomore as a way to stay in shape. I guess that worked out pretty well. He's a software engineer when he's not on the water. Joins us from Princeton, New Jersey, the boathouse there. Tom Pesek, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Good to be here.
First time to the Olympics. How do you feel?
I'm pretty excited. It's still all kind of sinking in, to be honest, but it's definitely a thrill.
Now, you were trying out for the eight-man boat. You ended up in a pair instead. What's the difference? Tell us, for those of us who haven't rowed at all or not much, what's the difference in those two, you know, styles of rowing when you get into this tip-top competition?
Sure. Well, the eight moves a little bit faster because you've got eight guys pulling on the oars instead of just two, so there's that. And also the fact that you only have one blade on either side of the water means that the pair ends up being a little more technique-oriented as well. It's a little less stable, a little more tipsy, so it takes a little extra concentration and focus to keep yourself from just flipping right over.
What distance will you be racing?
Everybody will race 2 kilometers, so it'll take anywhere from 5 to 7 minutes.
What's the world record in that?
In my event in the pair, the world record is 6:14.
And how are you guys doing so far? What's it look like as you prepare?
We're doing well. We're actually, Silas and I are a relatively new pair. The trials was actually the first time we've ever raced together in the pair. So in some ways, it's a lot of fun because we get to still see how fast we are. But we're looking good. We're feeling very optimistic about our chances, and we're looking forward to putting our nose out there to get up on the podium.
What do you think about, you know, when we civilians look at the Olympics, part of it is just the beauty of sport. Athletes like you competing at such a high level from all over the world, and that's great. And then there is also this other part of, you know, the family of man and woman at this showing sort of some beautiful aspect of humanity, something about, you know, world peace and together. I don't know, does that sing to you, Tom, as you prepare, or is it really just about we want to go there and win?
Well, it's a little bit tough to say. I mean, this will be my first Games, so I'm definitely looking forward to that aspect of it. Over the past several months, it's just been focused on winning. But I think as it kind of opens up, I definitely am looking forward to kind of that sense of community where, you know, everybody comes to the Olympics and politics and all the differences kind of get pushed aside. I'm definitely looking forward to that aspect of it as well.
Tom, let's hear from our listeners a little. Jennifer in Stevens City, Virginia. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have twin 7-year-old girls who are just going to be competing in gymnastics for the first time. So we have been waiting anxiously for the Olympics to come. It's been great with technology, I think, this time around. We have an iPad. So we've been watching the Olympic torch and making its way through, you know, the British Isles and all of that. And I think it's been a phenomenal opportunity to teach them, even though it's summer, you know, we do a little teaching every day about the world and who's doing what. So I think what we're really looking forward to is definitely seeing women competing. My one daughter is also an avid soccer player, so she's really excited. We have marked down the days of when all the soccer games are going to be on, when all the football games are going to be on. And I think it's just a tremendous opportunity for them to learn how to be a good competitor. So I'm looking forward to you know, like you were just talking about the peace with, you know, the goodwill
yeah.
of the games.
And Jennifer, let me ask you, they've got women's boxing for the first time at these Summer Olympics. Are you going to put your seven-year-olds watching that on the screen?
Well, unfortunately, we have boxing matches every night in the basement. So maybe in about 10 years, they'll be there if they still have boxing.
But they're on it already. We wish good luck to your daughters, Jennifer. Let's get one more. Bob in Jamestown, Kentucky. Bob, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to relate my Olympic experience was in Atlanta in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And what is so amazing is athletes train for years for their event, and then when it actually gets down to it, it's, you know, the finality of it, because often these events only last for 5 minutes.
What were you watching there, Bob, in Atlanta? What event were you watching?
Oh, I went to the rowing event, and that was real interesting. Of course, the United States didn't have a real strong team then. The Norwegians won it all, but that was the first time they had the paddling sports then, and then mountain biking.
Yeah.
And it was just, like I say, one thing you notice at the Olympics is that the spirit of camaraderie. I mean, you got party people from all over the world, and for 10 days they're all together. I mean, just having a, you know, a big time. It's just, you know, it's a wonderful experience if anybody ever gets a chance. You know, definitely catch it because, I mean, even when I had the problem with the Centennial Park bombing
yes,
and everything,
yes.
oversighting the security events, I mean, the Olympics is wonderful.
Bob, we appreciate your report. What about that, Tom? All that training for 5-6 minutes, you know, go like crazy on the water. Does it look like that ratio's out of whack to you, or that's just the athlete's view of life?
It's kind of amazing, but yeah, when we take a step back and look at it, and you train years and years for just a couple of minutes, it is pretty astounding. But it's also a lot of steps along the way. You know, there's trials, there's all the other races. So sure, it kind of ends up coming down to just those 6 minutes for me, but it always somehow is worth it.
Our listener says here, Hunger Games to entertain. Do you feel like, you know, the Hunger Games competitor out there to distract a troubled world, or just an athlete doing his thing?
I don't think I quite share that view exactly. It's mostly just us just training and just going out there and ready to compete.
Did you ever think, I mean, the word is you just saw a flyer for rowing, you know, when you were early in college, went out, tried it to stay in shape. Did you ever imagine early on that you'd be headed to the Olympics?
I certainly didn't, and not only that, but at Michigan, rowing is a club sport, so it's entirely self-supported by the students, you know,
wow. That's great.
Rent themselves out over the weekends for a few hours to make a few bucks to keep the program going. So I certainly never envisioned going from that to making it all the way up to the Olympic stage.
What do you think about when you're on the water? You've got that 6 minutes, and we hope 13 seconds. What do you think about in that time, Tom?
You know, like in the approach lead up to it, it's there's a lot of distractions. You kind of got to kind of make your way through it. But as soon as that horn goes, everything kind of just melts away. And it never has, and it's not going to matter how big the crowd is or how loud the crowd is or what's going on around me. It's always has been and always is going to be, you know, the next stroke. How can I make this next stroke even better than the last one?
Tom Pesek with us from Princeton, New Jersey today. Michigan man, he'll be there with Silas Stafford with the men's pair event at the Olympics in London. Tom, best of luck to you and Silas. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Alex, where are they going to be rowing? Where is it, in London or outside?
Yeah, it's going to be outside London, famous Eton, the Eton School, where
sure.
the Battle of Waterloo was supposedly won. With all those great lessons from
right.
athletics right near Windsor right. Castle.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the London Olympics opening ceremony 1 month from today. And we're talking with U.S. athletes preparing to compete in London in Federal Way, Washington on Sunday. The men's 3-meter diving qualifiers came down to the last dive. Chris Colwell rallied from third place to the top with a score of 99.75 in his final dive. NBC's Alex Flanagan anchored the event.
Chris Colwell loves this kind of pressure. It's a reverse 3.5. It's his favorite and his best dive in the last round. Oh, my! He has outdone himself today. Look at how high he goes above the springboard, and he nails the entry. Absolutely
vertical.
And that's just the path to the Olympics, the thing itself coming up in just 1 month. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK with Alex Wolf, senior staff writer for Sports Illustrated, joins us from London today. He's covering his sixth Summer Olympics. John Powers is with us from San Jose, California, veteran sports reporter, great one for the Boston Globe. He's covered the Olympic Games since 1976. He's been around and seen a lot. Welcome your question, your call. Here's one, John, for you. Chris writes to us. He says, what's really a drag about the four-year interval is that many of the elite athletes, particularly in sports like figure skating or gymnastics, have a pretty short time window when they're really at the top of their game. Some of them peak and are gone during that four-year gap. Getting a shot at the Olympic glory is as much about sheer luck on the timing as anything else. What do you say to that, John?
I think that is true. It's been a bit less true than it used to be. Now that athletes can make money from the sport, they can get subsidies, they can get endorsements, they can physically stay in the sport longer. It used to be, for example, if you were a boxer and you weren't ready on that year, you couldn't go. Or when the U.S. basketball team was all amateur, it was college seniors. And if you weren't a senior in the Olympic year, you didn't go. So I think it's been a bit easier to at least stick around and have more than one shot. For example, this will be Michael Phelps' fourth Olympics game.
Yeah, that's a lot. We're going to hear in just a moment from the great mountain biker, Georgia Gould. Tina in Greensburg, Kentucky. Thanks for calling, Tina. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just had a question for your panel about what they thought about Saudi Arabia possibly officially sanctioning women to compete in this year's games, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thanks for that, Tina. Alex Wolf, I think I read that what Saudi Arabia is sending a woman who will be riding dressage horseback. Is that right?
That's right, an equestrian, but shortly after, I think it was 2 days ago, the Saudi Olympic Committee made its announcement that it would be sending a woman. Came word, and we're still trying to sort this out, came word that the mount, the horse, is injured and she might not be able to make it. And this has led to a lot of speculation that the Saudi authorities feel under pressure because of the Arab Spring to make a gesture of openness and
right.
inclusion here, because the Brits in particular put a lot of pressure on them. They're very eager to see this, the first games where every country sends a woman. The question is whether the Saudis may have one or two other female athletes if this equestrian can't make it.
What other sports might they be in? And what about the speculation about whether this sport really went lame or, you know, just I guess that's what you're suggesting is maybe they just saying that. What other sports?
Well, I'm not aware, and this is something that's going to get sorted out. Here in London, I'm a little bit out of position to figure that one out. But as John mentioned earlier in the show, Brunei and I believe Qatar are also sending women for the first time. And this has been a kind of quadrennial human rights issue that's bubbled to the surface.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, one of the things about the Olympics, we bellyache about them and how so many of the noxious isms, commercialism and nationalism, kind of get folded into them. But if you look at the Olympic Charter, there's a lot of promise in it, and there have been, I think, certainly for women's rights groups over the last 10, 12 years, opportunities to bring real pressure to bear. In some ways, the Olympics are far ahead of, say, world soccer in this regard. So the hope is that the Saudis will get with the program.
John Powers, I don't know how up you are on dressage. I'm reading here that Ann Romney's, is Mitt Romney, presidential candidate's wife, who famously does horseback riding dressage. She's not going, but her horse is going. Rafalka headed to the Olympics. You know anything about that, John?
I had heard that. I mean, actually, Ann has been riding for a long time, loves it. And what is interesting here is that you are your horse. If your horse gets lame, you don't go. And it's always been an issue with the equestrians. For example, in Beijing, the riding wasn't done there. It was done in Hong Kong because of quarantine issues. The most amazing thing was in 1956 in Melbourne, they had the equestrian events in Stockholm. So
okay.
Never quite know who was going to turn up.
put him where they work. It will be very interesting to see if indeed Saudi women do show up in one sport or another for the Games. Let's talk with a great American woman who is on her way to London. Joining us right now from the UCI Mountain Bike World Cup in Windham, New York, is Georgia Gould, U.S. Olympic mountain biker, headed to London for her second Olympic Games. Georgia Gould, great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's your training like these days?
Well, I've got a big race coming up, so I'm actually not doing too much training. I'm sort of more in the resting and recovering stage.
Where will you be riding in the UK? Where's the course? What's it like?
The course is near Essex. It's sort of on the outside of London. It's mm-hmm. probably about an hour from where the Athlete Village is. But they've really done a great job designing and building a really interesting, exciting course that will be very spectator-friendly. I think you can stand in one spot and see virtually the entire course. So it should be really exciting.
You were in Beijing. It was hot as could be there, humid as well. Many said that affected your performance. I don't know, maybe the UK, it'll be foggy and misty.
I'm hoping for that.
Yeah.
No, it was definitely hot and humid in Beijing, and I didn't have quite the race I was hoping for there. So, but I've had a lot of opportunities to ride the course in London, and I competed on it last year and had a really great race. So, I know that I'm capable of riding a great race on the course, and I think just having a few extra seasons of racing and competition and experience under my belt just gives me a little bit more confidence, I guess, going into this next Games.
Georgia, what brought you to mountain biking? And when did you know or someone say to you, you know, Georgia, you might go all the way to the top of the world rankings here?
You know, after my first year of college, I moved from the East Coast out to Idaho. Sun Valley, Idaho, ski town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in the summer, I noticed I was there just hanging out and noticed that lots of people were riding mountain bikes around. And I just sort of decided to try it and thought it would be a great way to kind of explore the mountains and the woods around town. And it wasn't too long before I found a race that I could enter because I'm pretty competitive. So.
Wow.
And then, yeah, I just sort of worked my way up through the amateur ranks, and I wanted to kind of see how far I could take it. So I had no idea it would be this far, but that's why you always got to give it a shot.
Were you a great athlete as a kid, as a teenager?
No, actually, I didn't really do any major organized sports in high school or college. So I think I'm a good example of the fact that you can kind of get started a little bit later and still be still make it to the top.
Well, you take your bicycle out to see the mountains and woods of Idaho. Next thing you know, you're headed to the London Olympics. You're 32 years old now. You've beaten every other top mountain biker in the world. That means, I guess, you have to be shooting for the gold.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think it's a lot of pressure. We have really a competitive women's field internationally right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just a great opportunity. I'm really proud and excited and honored to be riding and racing with those top women and to be considered a contender. And I'm just, you know, hoping for my best race.
Hey, Georgia, stand by. We've got a George calling. Let's get you two together. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. George, you're on with Georgia.
I was a competitor in the trials for the 62 Olympics for 10,000 meters swimming.
Yeah,
and I'm now retired, and then looking back on my swimming career and my professional career, to me, the Olympics are a bit of a microcosm of many professional jobs we have. We train for sometimes the 2 or 3 minutes of the critical point of our life, and that might be for firefighters or for doctors or for many other professional areas, and the rest of the time, we're just doing the job a little bit by rote, and that's sort of our training. But we're really training for those 2 or 3 minutes of our performance, and that performance is, to me, analogous to what the Olympics are.
George, let's take it to Georgia. I appreciate your call from Myrtle Beach. How do you think you'll see this training and the goal of it? And, you know, there was George in the trials in 1962. When you're looking back, how do you hope to look back on this tip-top athletic part of your life, Georgia?
Well, you know, I hope to look back and see that, you know, I did everything I could to be the best that I could be and left it all out there. You know, I didn't want to look back and think, oh, what if I had tried to race professionally, or what if I had tried to go to the Olympics? So I'm really trying to do everything I can to really get the most out of this time in my career. You know, and I think what George said, you know, definitely the Olympics, you know, it's such a small time period of racing. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I have more than 2 minutes.
Yes.
We usually race for about an hour and a half. So.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the same time, it's just, it's another race. It's like any other race, except, of course, it's not. It's the Olympics.
Yes.
So, but I think that's the hard thing, is sort of having everything come together for just that one focused time. That's the difficult thing. But, you know, I've got a great coach, and things are going really well, so I'm hoping that I keep this momentum.
Georgia, you sound in great shape, and in the head anyway, and we're sure way beyond that, and we wish you very good luck in the London Olympics.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Georgia Gould. She's on her way to London as a mountain biker there, and a very good shot at the top. John Powers, you've watched a lot of people for a long time. How do you see Olympians look back on that experience? Do they all celebrate it? How do they look at it, you know, with a few years?
Well, I think over time, you know, at the beginning, there's so much excitement just walking in for the opening ceremonies. Of course, many
sure.
athletes never get to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Phelps still has not been to an opening ceremonies because his event is right off after that.
Mm-hmm.
I think right off the bat, they will judge, did I get a medal? Should it have been a better color? This and that. But with the advent of time, people realize how few people get to really experience that. To meet people from other countries, for example, you talk to the Cleary brothers about the 1960 hockey team in the middle of the Cold War, you know, sitting down with the Russians at breakfast and joking around with them. And those are the memories, when you talk to them now, that endure.
No question. I'm sure that's true. Let's get one more athlete in here while we can. Shreveport, Louisiana, Kendrick Ferris joins us. Olympic weightlifter, currently the only American male weightlifter qualified for the Games. Kendrick Ferris, boy, you got a lot on your shoulders. Thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate you having me, man. How you doing?
We're doing very well. So what's your training like as Olympic weightlifter? What are you doing every day to be ready?
Oh, man, we're working hard. You know, we're training 5 days a week. Each session is about 3 hours, and then we do post-workout, which is probably about an hour, hour and a half.
An hour and an hour and a half of lifting what size of what weight of weights, Kendrick?
Oh, man, the training, the lifting weights, that's about 3 hours. The post is about an hour and a half. So, I mean, we're doing a variety of exercises. We're doing back squats. We're doing some of our competition lifts. We're doing some other supplement exercises. Man, I was doing some jerks the other day with over 400 pounds for reps. So that's the type of training we're doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kendrick, what do you figure you'll have to lift at the Games to get, into that small number of people who walk away with top rankings?
I'm thinking maybe if I could, stay within, I guess, fifth place in our first portion of the competition, and that's our snatch lift, and then the clean and jerk. I may have to go for an Olympic record or maybe a world record. And those are some lifts that I've been able to do in training, and now it's just about getting out there on the platform and getting it done.
How many pounds do you hope to hit?
Somewhere around 480 pounds, maybe a little bit more. So that'll be the plan. That'll be a world record, and we haven't had an American do that in, I think, over 50 or 60 years.
And Kendrick, I'm reading here that you're raising money through an online campaign to get your family over there with you. We've got a link to that at our website for listeners who want to help out. Who would you like to have there? How's that going?
Oh, man, everything is going wonderful. We just did a small fundraiser over at Buffalo Wild Wings, and I had a lot of people came out and they supported that. I'm trying to get my wife, my son, my mom, my sisters, and my brother and my nephew. I know there's a lot of people, but and they don't really get to come to competitions with me. And just to hear those familiar voices, you know what I mean, I think it'll give me a little extra power to do what I do best.
Words can't explain the feeling I get when I hear my mom's voice at a competition you've been quoting saying, there's where the extra power comes from.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I love it, man. She says the same thing she's been saying it for years. Ever since I started lifting, she would always just say, take your time, baby. She always says that. I love to hear it. You know what I mean? It just kind of keeps me calm.
It's only 480 pounds. Take your time, baby. Kendrick Ferris, you sound strong and you sound good. We wish you the very best of luck in London. Thank you very much for being with us today.
I appreciate you having me on, sir.
Thanks so much for joining us. Kendrick Ferris, he will be lifting weights for the USA team in London. Alex Wolf, you remind us that the British have a special respect for this kind of affair, and yet there's been a little grumpiness on the way to this. What kind of tone do you expect as we get on the really in the last days heading up to the Games?
Well, first of all, what Kendrick just said about his mother's advice, just take your time, baby, it reminds me a little bit of keep calm, carry on,
yes.
Which has been very much the mantra here. You know, if we go back to 1948, London has on two previous occasions hosted the Games. And in 48, it was right after the wreckage of World War II. And there was a lot of negativism on the walk up to the Games. And then people flipped, you know, the opening ceremonies, the great crowds, and I'm suspecting that that's what we're going to see this time, too.
John Powers, you'll be there. You think the Games will outshine austerity in the end?
I think they will. I mean, one thing that happens, you know, basically, this is like a world that exists only for 2 weeks. No one sees it coming, really, even though they think they're ready for it. And after the Games are over, you get this almost a postpartum depression.
Yeah.
You know, there's this great sigh when the closing ceremonies happen and they turn out the candle.
Well, we hope to give birth to some glory here. John Powers in San Jose, California. Good luck at the Games. Thanks for joining us very much today. And Alex Wolf with Sports Illustrated in London. Alex, thanks. Thanks to you both. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.